Welcome, everybody, to tonight's program. And we're celebrating the Mother Principle. Happy Mother's Day, everybody. So I always like to begin my programs by remembering my Mata Pita, which is my guru, Baba. And he would begin his program, every program, by saying in Hindi, Sabko Barasan Mane Kesat, Prem se radik swagat. With great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. And that was the spirit that he wanted to conduct his programs in, and we want to conduct our programs that way too. So with great love and respect, I welcome you all. And I want to welcome also everyone watching, considerable amount of people watching in the global satsang online. God, I feel like mentioning everyone, but I can't. The United States, in New York and Ann Arbor, in Canada, and then Ramdas is in Ganeshpuri, in Japan, in Serbia, and all around Australia. Oh, in Adelaide. Hello, Adelaide. In the Blue Mountains. And then in Brisbane, two different groups are watching. We're going to be visiting you guys very soon. So let me say hello to all of you. Shivananda and group and Pratibha, Karuna, Nitya, so many people watching up in Brisbane. And Byron Bay also, Oya, Tuyaji, and Julie and Shamala. We're coming to Byron Bay in Brisbane pretty soon. What?
Not till August. August.
In August. That's pretty soon, isn't it? Yes. Who knows? The time just goes by. And of course, in Melbourne, Jyoti is watching. We want to say hello to Jyoti. And also Patricia and Bernard watching. And in Gippsland, we've got people watching Gippsland and in Mount Eliza. So, in fact, in this very ashram. one of the people watching, I got an email from Nitya in Brisbane, and she just made one comment which I thought I'd share. She said, the other day while doing japa to your japa track, that's where I rap the mantra. And she said, I had a realization of just how ancient the mantra is and how fundamental an impulse it is to bow in reverence to the sky of consciousness, no matter what culture we're coming from. Truly, it's a universal and a very wonderful business. You know, I was talking about this today, actually, is that if you can use your intellect to stabilize your mind, that's very good. If you use right understanding and you say, well, that's obviously I'm thinking the wrong way because I'm feeling so miserable, therefore I will bring in some of the teachings and uplift my mind, that's called jnana yoga, wisdom. It's a great thing. But a lot of times it's going to happen that your mind doesn't work. When your mind is flooded with negative emotion, with despair, with anger, with jealousy, with fear, it usually doesn't work very well yogically. So it's at times like that that you need a brutal, vital practice, like just brutally saying the mantra. Because you don't have to use your mind, you just keep repeating the mantra. And that has a magical effect. That in those kinds of situations, when you can't get yourself out of it through a right understanding, mantra can uplift you. So there. So for Mother's Day, my tradition is usually to draw on the teachings of one of the great women saints who I had the privilege. She was the first saint that I met when I got to India. I was searching for great beings. And within just a short time, I had darshan of this great being, Anandamayi Maa, And she looked like that when I met her. She was born in 1896, and I met her in 1970, so she was 74, and she lived till 1982. And as a young woman, very beautiful young woman, very peculiar and very spiritual. And when she was young, you know, she had just this affinity for spirituality. And then she had this extraordinary Kundalini awakening. Unique, you know, as Ramana Maharshi's awakening was unique, where in 20 minutes he became enlightened as a 16-year-old kid. Well, hers was another example. These are like two superhuman spiritual figures. So if you plan to be like either one of them, the odds are about 10 billion to one against you. You're probably going to have to do it the hard way by sweating out your sadhana and working on it. But anyway, what happened to her is she had this awakening and she became, the guru and disciple appeared within her. She became the guru and the disciple. And she got a Kundalini awakening, started having lots of kriyas and movements that lasted for a long time. And finally she was established in that state. So that's good. Better put the picture down. Is that it? Yeah, okay. And she was, somewhere in this business, she got married, and her husband discovered to his amazement and that his wife was one of the great saints of the 20th century, which led to complexities, I would imagine. But he became her devotee. And then soon she had devotees all over India. She would travel around. And she was very, very, very humble. She would always refer to herself as a child. And she talked about this body, talked about herself in that way. But she was also very strong. At the same time she was that way, she was, she taught strict Advaita Vedanta and so on, and didn't pull her punches. And she became the guru of Indira Gandhi, and Baba and she met each other. Baba describes it somewhere in the in one of his books. Anyway, these are some of the teachings of Ananda Maima, and I'm going to finish off with something from Baba also. Now, that was interesting. Vani was talking about namaskar. What was that about namaskar?
Namaste.
Oh, namaste, from Larry. Larry. namaste. Well, so here's something about namaskar, which is pranam. Pranam is to bow. It's also to bow on the ground, and this is an act of respect and worship that's done habitually in India, not only to great beings, but often children do that to their parents, which is a very big switch from Western culture. But this writer says, today, Ma, Ananda Mai Ma, gave a marvelous talk about pranam, or rather namaskar, as she called it. She said, to do namaskar means to put one's head in its rightful place, namely at the feet of God. The feet of God are everywhere, and therefore one can do namaskar anywhere and to anyone or anything. So, well, she's famous for her, what she called her kayals, which are spiritual moods. The only one close to that is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the first saint in the Hare Krishna line back in, I don't know what century he was, 14th century or before that. And he would get kayals. He would have these moods, spiritual moods, where he'd be taken over by divine power. And in a certain mood, you bow to everything. You see God everywhere. It means to open oneself to the divine power, which is always streaming down on everyone. Very interesting line. Imagine that the divine power, the power of upliftment, joy, illumination, and grace, is always streaming down. In other words, it's always available. So then it makes sense to want to put yourself in, open to that power, to open to that divine power. All the religions all talk about it. And she's saying that the way to do it is by being humble, to be open and let this stream of grace suffuse you. So it's always streaming down everyone, but we close ourselves against it. Pardon. To pranam means to give one's mind to him and to give oneself, so that there should only be one and not two, no other. If you can do nothing else, at least do namaskar. It should be done with the whole body. One that is practical, at least with the mind. First with the intake, now she gives a method, actually, of doing it. First with the intake of the breath, one receives his power, that divine power, into oneself. And then with the exhalation, one bows down and breathes out the ego and remains like this as long as possible in kumbhak, with the breath naturally suspended. So it's a meditation method. We breathe in the divine power, and we breathe out our separateness, our ego, and then we stay in that state. This is all to commune mystically with that higher power. And what the sages all represent is the existence, a very concrete, real existence of this higher power, called many different things in different traditions. And it's available to all of us, but somehow we hide from it. We don't see it. She says, this is meditation. When doing namaskar to a consecrated image or to a living guru, which is also a vigraha or a consecrated image, one should always first look at it so as to get the inner conviction to do the namaskar. She says, when this body was playing the game of sadhana, so immediately she's saying, this body, this person, it was Anandamayi, when she was playing the game of sadhana, she had confided at some point that she was actually born in that state, in the highest state. And so the sadhana that she did was only a game, it was a show for other people's benefit. But so he says, the hand that offered the food while doing puja became one with the oblation and the act of offering, and the body remained as if frozen like this for hours. So she would go into these states. So she's offering food to the deity. So she holds it out like this and then becomes frozen in that for hours. I've seen people in trances like that. It happens. So it says, lots of big red ants would collect and eat the food and crawl all over this body and get entangled in the hair, but never a single ant bit it. When the body came to, it felt God had come and partaken of the offerings in the form of the ants who are running about on it. God in the form of ants was walking, jumping, and playing all over this body. Like this, it has become the kingdom of God. That's what I felt. Not disgust that insects had come and eaten the food. When doing pranam, offer all of yourself, the good as well as the bad. So that's Anandamayi Ma's. Here's another one, very similar. The writer says, the Varanasi ashram was inaugurated in 1945. So when you were in Varanasi, did you visit her ashram there? Did you see it? Yeah. You saw it there? And her samadhi shrine, where she's buried, is in Hardwar, in Kankal in Hardwar. And Some of us who went, whatever year that was, 2009, visited, somebody was just there recently, somebody told me. You guys, yeah, okay. Anyway, it was inaugurated in 1945, although by now quite an imposing block of buildings, it never seems to near completion. Some construction or other is usually in progress. That can't be true now, can it? No. Bricks and other building material had been heaped up in a corner of the courtyard. One afternoon, about 2 or 3 o'clock, Mataji suddenly rushed out of her room and walked straight towards that pile of rubble, shouting, "Quickly, remove all this! Some plants are being choked underneath." Those present at once set to work. Sure enough, 5 pomegranate plants were found hidden below the bricks. No one had remembered they were there. Ananda Mayama explained, "When I was lying on my bed resting, these plants came to me pleading for their lives, drawing my attention to the fact that they were in danger of being suffocated." Yeah, well, there you go. Okay, here we go. In February 1955, some Italians had come to Varanasi for Mataji's darshan, and they asked some questions. So one of them says, I really like this question and answer, "Which is right for me, to live an active life in the world or a contemplative life in seclusion?" What do you think Ananda Mayama will say? She gives the ultimate and greatest answer. Ready? She says, "To whichever of the two you can give your heart and soul, that is right for you." Isn't that great? Wonderful. "Have you anything to say to me?" questioned a young woman who had traveled all the way to India to study Buddhism. "Mataji, live the teaching that you profess." And the third person wanted to know, "How can I avoid saying the wrong thing at the wrong time?" You have that called foot and mouth disease. Right? Yeah, very practical answer. She said, "By waiting before you speak." If you pause for a little while, you may think better of it and never say it at all. You might even be silent. Another one. "I know that certain people have a bad influence on me, yet I fall a victim to it. Is there a way of saving myself from it?" That's a very interesting and relevant question. Mataji says, practically, "Curtail to a minimum the time you spend in their company." The question happened to be an American film actress. "How can I," she said, "my work forces me not only to be with them, but also to eat and live with them." And Mataji says, "How then can you save yourself from their influence? If you go near fire, won't you feel its heat? If you put ice on your hand, won't it freeze?" So what is she saying? So that you've chosen that life, so you have to deal with it. "We feel greatly honored to have had the privilege of meeting Mataji," said one of the foreigners on taking leave. Ananda Mayama said, "Honored? When you meet another, you may feel honored. But when you come to your own self, there's only joy and happiness." So that was her bhav, to see only herself. A little one on, final one, on mantra, not the final one, another little bit one. This is from Hardwar, 1953. With regard to a question about mantra, she said, "There is power in the mantra, in the akshara, the indestructible essential vibration of the letters, and it is possible at any time for that state to be revealed, which in any case is always there, in which the seer, the seeing, and the seen are one. You know, the yogis always talk about this dichotomy, the seer and the seen, the one who views and that. And then sometimes they say the third part of that is the act of seeing. And so in the highest mystical state, seer and seen become one. There's not that split. So that's saying that that's always there and that state can reveal itself. Then added to this, there's the power of the guru. This is behind the mantra. The guru plants a seed in you, and there's no doubt the fruit will come forth someday. So she's saying that if you have the mantra from a guru, from the lineage, and you repeat it, it will bear fruit. Whether you notice it or not, it grows inside you. Your task is to obey his orders so that the seed may grow properly. The spiritual seed of the mantra cannot be spoiled. It is there, and it must bear fruit at some point. And finally, this is one little statement of hers. She says, and this is, I think, a dharana or a contemplation. If a person regards the Almighty as his one and only support, leaving all matters to him, God himself will draw him towards his goal. So what he's saying is to rely entirely on that higher power. Do not forget one thing. In actual fact, nothing exists but the One. So this is what the teaching of the sages is. They say that in actual fact, only the One consciousness exists. Every tradition, the Vedantic tradition says that only Brahman is real. Kashmir Shaivism says that all Nashivam say nothing exists that is not Shiva. There's only this, and yet we live in duality and suffering. But if we understand and accept that teaching, we understand that, we keep it in the back of our mind. We're not experiencing it every moment. We're experiencing duality, we're experiencing a feeling of lack, a feeling sometimes of despair, and so on. But we know in the back of our minds that there is a higher truth that we're not capable of accessing in this moment. So don't forget that thing. In actual fact, nothing exists but the One. If you think without a wife or son or husband, you'll miss all the good they have done for you, you're greatly mistaken. Things go wrong in your life that you won't be able to live. Not true. He who is the creator of all has made perfect arrangements for all his creatures. Keep in mind, thou art father, mother, friend, and master. There is no cause whatever for worry. You don't have to be worried about anything because that higher power is operating. That's Ananda Mayama. That's she's giving a secret of the blissful state that she lived in, of total surrender and faith in that higher power. And the reason we are not in that state is because we don't have that perfect surrender. Now to another thing. I've got a thing by another yogi, this chap. My guru, Swami Muktananda, and he wrote a wonderful spiritual autobiography called Play of Consciousness. And I read it in manuscript back in the days of my residency in his ashram in India back in the early 70s. And it used to make me pass out. I couldn't read more than a page of the book. It had so much Shakti in it that I would pass into meditation. It was really annoying. It was not annoying. But I couldn't make much progress reading it. And one of the most remarkable things is the dedication of the book, which is a dedication to his mother and to the Divine Mother. And nowhere else does Baba speak so personally and candidly in this, and very touchingly. So here it is. This is Baba's dedication of Play of Consciousness. Let's keep his picture there. What do you think? He says, my mother loved me very much, for I was her only son. She was a devotee of Lord Shiva, and it was her worship of Parashiva Shakti, which had given me to her as a boon of his grace. You know, in India, the parents are always praying, going to the temple. We want a son, we want a daughter, you know, give us a child. And they're always getting, you read all the saints' lives, they all happen like that. The mother went to pray to Lord Shiva, and so this divine avatar came forward. So, anyway, but Baba says, but I could not give any happiness to my mother, nor could I make her contented. Instead, I left home when I was young, and so caused her a lot of pain. She wasted away in grief for her lost son and finally died, remembering me all the time. Well, she says, children owe a great debt to their mothers. Mothers feed their children with their own vital juices. They give up their own happiness and find it in their children's happiness. What must my mother have done for her dear son? What ideas and plans she must have had for me? How many gods and goddesses she must have propitiated for the sake of my happiness? She must have asked all the astrologers, what sort of wife will my son have? How many children will he have? Will he become famous? Will he go to other countries? How many factories will he open? Will his mother be a source of joy to him? Slightly self-interested, that question. This is how a mother loves her children. If an astrologer says something ominous, she will immediately start propitiating all the gods. She will keep fast not only on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, but every day if she can. When a child goes to school, she keeps thinking, when is he coming home? Why hasn't he come yet? She looks inside and outside again and again. She looks at the clock. She waits for the sound of the car. Why hasn't my child come? Extraordinary, isn't this? A child is indebted to his mother for her infinite care of him. Still, the hard-hearted child leaves her, giving, in God knows how many ways, violent blows to her maternal affections. My predicament was similar. I was slightly over 15 when one day I left the love of my mother and father far behind. I should not have done such a thing. But what could I do? I was destined to behave so callously. It was supposed to happen, and so it did. He left home at 15 searching for God, and he wandered and he lived in ashrams and traveled around. When I came to my senses, I remembered my mother. This was during the time of my sadhana, when I was a wandering fakir, practicing the yoga of meditation and engaged in my studies on the spiritual path. So he remembered, felt guilty. How many mothers have looked after me, giving me food and drink, clothes, things for my daily bath and other necessities? They did everything for me in just the way that appealed to my temperament and suffered many hardships for it. For my nature was a bit fiery and I lacked patience. If they brought food at 11:15 instead of 11, I would fly into a rage, yelling, why are you late? If it was brought 5 minutes early, I'd get angry and shout, why are you so early? During the period of my sadhana, my temperament was extremely peculiar and arrogant. Yet how much love these mothers gave me. They really are my revered mothers, who did so much for me. With hearts full of pure and selfless devotion, they fed me and put up with my disposition. If the food was seasoned a bit too much or too little, I would not eat it. If it was too hot or too cold, I would want to know why. How shameful. Even I don't know why I was not able to bear even petty mistakes. I was merciless with them. I never excused them, and I felt no remorse about it. Those mothers served me with their own expense and toil, even neglecting their own children for my sake. But still, I had no compassion for them, no forgiveness. Oh, Lord, why did you give me such an arrogant nature? I don't know. Wonderful. All these mothers, including sweet, affectionate, and loving mothers from Delhi and Bombay, still regard me as a temperamental child and give me their motherly affection with faith, devotion, and love. When I go on a journey, they come with me. Why? to cook Baba's food. Well, even if I'm traveling throughout the whole of India, I always eat at 11:30. So the mothers get up at 3 in the morning to prepare my food and put it in the car. I make it a strict rule to stick to the planned time of departure, so they have to get everything ready very quickly. Baba would just go if it wasn't ready. Then the food has to be kept warm while we're on the road, so they use thermoses. Because tea has to be ready at 3 p.m., they take a stove and milk in the car with them so that while we're moving, tea can be ready on time. They have kept my filial affection alive by undergoing such hardships. Remaining unperturbed, they've borne my peculiar temperament and put up with my fastidious ways. This would not have been possible if a part of my real mother were not in them. Many mothers and their husbands have been good to me in many different ways. As I remember them, I beg them to forgive me generously. I bow to you, mothers, with all my heart, seeing you each as my own mother, the one who gave birth to me. I pray to Bhagwan Nityananda that I may always see in you that same mother, Goddess Chitti Kundalini, whom I love so much. That's his introduction. How's that? Beautiful. So, in honor of Mother's Day, we salute the Divine Mother, Mother Principle. And Baba always said, the mother is the first guru. The mother educates us and loves us, takes care of us. So let's meditate. We meditate for about 10 minutes. And we'll begin with the Shiva process meditation. Let's see if we can tailor it to the event of Mother's Day. So let's close our eyes. Go within. Bring your attention to the navel area. Feel the feeling in the navel area. Does that feel tense or relaxed? Bring in the thought, I let go, I relax. Relax the navel area. Bring the attention up to the heart. Feel the feeling in the heart. Does that feel open or closed? Does it feel pleasant or unpleasant? The heart is the seat of the principle of the Divine Mother. And the principle of the Mother is to love. So say, I love, I give my love, I receive love, I remember the Divine Mother, I remember my own mother. Bring your attention up to the throat. This is the communication center. Feel the feeling in the throat. Does it feel blocked or open? Are the words flowing in the throat or are they locked up? Bring in the thought, I speak words of love. I speak words of love to myself and to others. Words of praise, words of generosity, and words of love. Now bring our attention up to the third eye. Beware of the feeling in the third eye. Is the third eye dark or full of light? Is it contracted or expanded? Begin the thought, I let my third eye open to the light. I let all of wisdom, all of knowledge, all of understanding, divine brilliance and light flow into my third eye. I can glimpse the highest truth. Now let's meditate for 7 more minutes.